You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests. But we hope you still enjoy listening. Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspiration.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our studio guest today is Nicola Upson, here to talk about her novel Stanley and Elsie, based on the life of the artist Stanley Spencer. We'll also hear from Kate Fleet and Angela Kogo about their book for children, Monty Mouse of Cambridge Town. And Dennis Grube is here to talk about Megaphone Democracy, his book on the increasing public role civil servants play in political life. A very eclectic show. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Nicola, but welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Nice to have you. Monty Mouse of Cambridge Town. What are your links to Cambridge? Because you weren't born here, were you?
No, I was born in Bury St Edmunds, so just down the road in Suffolk, and I came to university here. I read English at Downing, and I sort of stayed, like lots of
like
my friends
of
did. And not only did the ones who stay, but the ones who went away, some of them have drifted back. It does have that kind of magnetic pull, so I've been here ever since.
And you've set some of your novels here.
Yes, I have. It took me a while to get around to setting Nine Lessons here, because so many people have set books in Cambridge, particularly working within the crime genre. There have been a lot of good crime novels set in partially or completely in Cambridge. So I had to sort of wait until I found something that I really, really wanted to write about, which was typically Cambridge, but which would also fit in with the series of books I was doing, which are set in the 1930s. And I stumbled upon M.R. James. I've always loved his ghost stories. So he became, and Nine Lessons, obviously the title, and that carol service that he was instrumental in setting up with Eric Milner White at King's. So that was my Cambridge setting.
A good place to write, not just because it's picturesque. There's a good writing community here, isn't there?
There is. Lots of encouragement and lots of inspiration and a good healthy bit of, just healthy competition.
And good crime writers. There's loads
yes.
of crime writers
yes.
in Cambridge.
Yes, yeah.
We're going to hear your first choice of music now. Is music important to you?
Music's really important to me. My partner, Mandy, obviously is a musician, as many listeners to 105 will know, as well as a radio presenter and now an author. So we have an awful lot of music in our house. It's something huge that when we got together, it was important to us, and it still is. And I always listen to music while I'm working, really. And today I've chosen the music which I listened to a lot while I was writing Stanley and Elsie, set in the 1920s and 30s English rural countryside. And it really does help me to get into the mood and the tone of the book, having that music around me while I'm working.
So this explains The Lark Ascending, which
Indeed.
Is your first choice, Vaughan Williams. That's The Lark Ascending by Vaughan Williams, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Nicola Upson. Nicola's debut novel, An Expert in Murder, published in 2008, featured the novelist Josephine Tay as heroine and detective. Critically acclaimed, it was also dramatised for Radio 4's Woman's Hour. Six more Josephine Tay books followed, with Nine Lessons, the seventh in the series, shortlisted for the Crime Writers Association Historical Dagger Award. Stanley and Elsie is a standalone novel about the artist Stanley Spencer and his relationship with women, most notably his maid, Elsie Mundy, his first wife, Hilda Carline, and the artist Patricia Priest. So I suppose one of the obvious questions, Nicola, is having written a series, why a standalone novel now and why this subject?
Well, I always knew that I'd want to write a book that wasn't in the series, and I was looking around for a story, as you, not particularly actively, but just open to ideas if they came along. And I've also always loved the work of Stanley Spencer from when I was a very little girl. I remember having a postcard of The Resurrection Cookham, that vast canvas of his, which is now on the Tate, which is a picture of the church and churchyard that he loved in his home village in Berkshire. And it is, as people know if they've seen that canvas, a very sort of everyday story of people rising from their graves for the resurrection. And although at that age I had no concept of what that painting was really about, I obviously something really struck me. And being in Cambridge and so close to the Fitzwilliam Museum, which have a fantastic collection of Spencer's paintings, that obviously also kept my interest up as well. And I remember being at the Fitzwilliam when there was an exhibition on called Sergeant Sickert Spencer, and walking into that and spending quite a lot of time in that exhibition. And there were all the big Stanley Spencer paintings that I knew the Fitz had and knew well. But there was also this much smaller, innocent-looking pencil drawing of a young woman in a maid's uniform who was what looked to me flirting at the front door with a postman or a delivery man or something like that. And the curator, Jay Monroe, had chosen some extracts from Spencer's writings, because as well as being prolific as an artist, he wrote thousands and thousands and thousands of words about his own work and his life. And what he said about Elsie, he talked about when he hired her while he was painting the First World War chapel in Berkeley, which no doubt we'll go on to talk about. He hired a maid from a nearby village called Elsie Monday, and their life together was as light as the air. She looked after him and his family, and he said they blew about like a couple of rooks in a cottage in a field by the railway cutting. And there was just something so lovely about that, so completely different to the Stanley Spencer I'd read about with various other women in his life. His marriage to Hilda Carline, also an artist, that was difficult. His disastrous and doomed relationship with Patricia. But this relationship with Elsie was a genuine friendship based on mutual respect and affection. And by the time I left the museum, I sort of knew that would be the standalone novel, although it took another 10 years to actually have it published.
So she was your way into him, and she's our way into him as
she
well.
She is. I think a friend of mine put it very nicely, where she said she always felt safe in those terrifying households, the Carlines and the Priestess, because they are full of such dominant and not always pleasant personalities. But she always felt safe because she had Elsie there with her. And she is exactly what you've just said. She's our way into that world, and a slightly different look at Spencer. And it's interesting, I think, because there are other narrators in the book. Elsie is the main one, but we also hear from Hilda and Patricia. And it's interesting for me to have that gaze turned back on Spencer, because he painted the women in his life ruthlessly, not always very flatteringly. So it's nice to have that stare turned back at him and see him through their eyes. And I think he comes alive as somebody who was a genius, not as eccentric perhaps as he's been painted by various people, because it always struck me about Stanley Spencer is he always had an eminently practical reason for doing something. Like, there's been much made of how he would put his clothes over his pyjamas and go out to paint. I mean, why wouldn't you on a cold day in Cookham? So you see him as perhaps human and irritating, but also, I hope, quite likeable too.
Yes, I mean, how much did you use what he had written and his paintings? Obviously, substantially, I would have thought, but it is his view of the world, isn't it? And his view of the women.
It is, and I think particularly when you come to the chapel, that cycle of 19 paintings, which took him 5 years to do, as Hilda comments at one point, longer than the actual First World War lasted. So I was very, very interested in what he wrote about those paintings, as well as studying the paintings very closely himself, because they are all about him. He is a character in those paintings, and he had a very unusual war. When you look at those, they don't look like the war paintings that we associate with people like Nash and Nevinson, and they are much more domestic. They are part of his life as a medical orderly in Bristol before he went out to serve in Macedonia, and they, like his view on everything, are unique to him.
And the sense of place in the novel is very strong. I mean, there's Cookham, there's Berkeley, that's how you pronounce it, and the chapel. You must have visited all those places.
Yeah, I did. I love all my novels. Setting is a really big starting point. So whilst Elsie was the big way into these from a character point of view, certainly Berkeley and the chapel from a setting point of view was the second big catalyst to working on the novel. And you go there today and he had an amazing pair of patrons called the Barons, who loved his work and had seen his drawings for this cycle of paintings, which he'd started working on long before he ever got to fulfil them. And they were just incredible people. They were big patrons of the arts, not just of Spencer, but They paid his rent on his London flat while he was finishing The Cookham Resurrection. They built a house for him and his young family to live in while he was painting the chapel. They paid for the chapel to be built according to his specifications with an architect that he approved of. And of course, they paid for him to have these paintings. But their one insistence was that that chapel must be in their home of Berkeley, where they lived. And he was a bit harumphy about that. He'd much rather have done it in Cookham. But it's so lovely, I think, that it is there, because you go there today, and although the house, Chapel View, that he and Hilda and Shireen lived in is almost unrecognisable, that chapel in the middle of the field and the countryside around, which was the inspiration for Watership Down, some of those horizons as well, is almost as it would have been while he was painting it. You walk up, you open the gate to the chapel and you walk up this red brick path, and there's a little well in the middle and apple trees, of course, which are now old and lovely, which would have been new when he was there. And you can see him in your mind's eye coming across the railway cutting from the cottage to do another day's work at the chapel, where he worked only in natural light, very, very long hours. And he always worked with quite a small brush. You see these amazing sized canvases. And how incredible to think that he worked his way across those with tiny brushes according to a plan that he had in his head years before. So that was a huge inspiration. And Cookham, obviously, which now is a sort of Spencer village, really, because he painted so much of it. And everywhere you look, one of those paintings comes to mind. So it was lovely for me within the novel to take a painting of his that I loved and create a dramatic scene around it. So there's things with Elsie, with workmen that come to visit, and Moor Thatch, which is where Patricia lived. And also Hampstead. It was lovely to go to Hampstead and see, because Hilda Carline always wanted to move back to Hampstead. That was part of the many divisions between them, was that she wanted to go back to where she had lived with her family in Hampstead. She was more a city girl than Stanley was. And so all those settings were hugely important in the novel, because they had such an important mark on the personalities, those very strong personalities that were created.
It was beautiful landscape writing. Fantastic. There,
we had to go to Cookham and Berkeley a lot. It was awful.
What a drag.
Yeah. Although I never went to Downton Abbey, because it's just down the road from Highclere.
And how did you find out about Elsie? I mean, imagine that, as you say, it's relatively easy to find out things about Stanley, perhaps easier Hilda and Patricia. But Elsie is a working class woman. What did you know about her?
Well, part of the reason that Elsie is such a good vehicle for the narrator of this book is that not much is known about her, particularly in the family. You've got the paintings that Stanley did, and he painted her a lot and sketched her a lot. There's his writings about her, obviously. And there's a short paragraph. There was a book on Spencer, which was published, I think, in the 1970s, which was a collection of his letters and Hilda's letters and memories of the people who knew him. And Elsie contributed a very brief paragraph to that, where she talked about trying to keep him tidy and how he always thought that, you know, artists should be more interested in a paintbrush than a hairbrush, and how much he liked the meals he cooked and how much she enjoyed taking the children out. So very, very discreet. Nothing. The wonderful thing about Elsie, I think, is that she didn't, like many good servants didn't, she didn't talk about the life. Her children were grown and married before they knew she had even worked for the Spencers. But I was lucky enough to correspond with her son, Gordon. She had two children, sadly. Irene was no longer with us by the time I started the book. But I had a very lovely and old-fashioned correspondence with her son, Gordon. I would write him letters of questions, and he would write back and answer them. So I got a sense from him of how he viewed her as a mother, what she liked, what she didn't like, just tiny domestic details, but quite important in the general building up of her character. And the other thing that really went into Elsie's character was probably my own grandmother on my father's side, who had worked in service and was pretty much a contemporary of Elsie's, born in the very early part of the 20th century, and was a country woman and worked in service and had a huge respect and affection for the people that she worked for. And so that influenced the novel a lot.
She's quite
as well.
Feisty though, Elsie, isn't she?
She is quite feisty. Well, you had to be, really, because she's got to have the respect and the loyalty to the Spencers, and she's got to work very, very hard. Let's, you know, from the moment she wakes up to the moment she goes to bed, hard physical work, because it's an interesting time. It's the decline of the big houses with lots of servants, and Elsie was sort of a general, which meant she did everything from chopping the wood, doing the washing, looking after Shireen and Unity, and there's pictures of her doing all the sketches that Spencer did. But she is feisty. She's got to be feisty because I don't think you would have lasted that long in the Spencer household trying to tread that awful line. That was Elsie's biggest job, was trying to balance Stanley's needs and desires with Hilda's needs and desires and trying to be the glue that held that marriage together. So I think you've got to have a certain presence of mind and a certain ability to speak that presence of mind, really.
How conscious were you of a modern female perspective on this particular love triangle?
Well,
because Stanley's calling the shots to a large extent.
Stanley's trying to call the shots. Yes, I agree with you on that. But just for listeners who might not necessarily know the story, he was happily married to Hilda. They had two small children. And just before the second child was born, he, in Cookham, walked into a tea shop that he'd known since his childhood and met a woman called Patricia Preece, who happened to be looking after the tea shop that day. And Patricia Preece was living in Moor Thatch in Cookham. She was an artist. She'd been to the Slade. But she was living with her friend and lifetime lover, Dorothy Hepworth. They met at the Slade and they spent their life together. So from a modern perspective, and from any perspective, really, you might know that was never going to work as a relationship. But Spencer was self-destructive to the end. His marriage was torn apart by his obsession with Patricia. He subsequently went on to marry Patricia. But that marriage was never consummated. Dorothy went on the honeymoon and she never lived with him. And all that, it's been called, one of the reviews of the book called it the greatest soap opera in the history of art. And I think that that's probably very, very accurate. But when you think about it, Spencer wasn't doing anything much more than a lot of men of that generation and that age thought they were entitled to. Lots of men committed adultery. Lots of men had affairs and thought it was perfectly fine to do that. The difference with Stanley is that he talked about it. He was honest about it. He wanted to legitimise it. He wanted two wives. He didn't see why he should have to make do with just one, because his big tragedy is that he always loved Hilda and he never had the sense to realise that. I mean, one of the most insightful things Spencer ever said about himself, I think, was all things have to be memorials for me to love them. And of course, it was really only after Hilda's death that he continued to write to her and valued that relationship as he should have done. And throughout her, it's fair to say, when Hilda was very ill in the 1940s, and he was as wonderful and attentive to her then as he had been cruel and destructive when he was younger.
It's a fascinating novel, Nicola. Thank you. We'll come back to you in just a moment. Let's take a slight sidestep now and hear from Dennis Grube. Dennis is a lecturer in public policy at the University of Cambridge and a former political speechwriter. For his book, Megaphone Democracy, he interviewed civil servants, parliamentary private secretaries and NGO chiefs about the increasingly public role they're playing in political life. When I met Dennis, I asked him what prompted him to write the book.
It draws together my two great research interests from the last decade, really. The first is political rhetoric, the power of language in our politics and how it works. And the second is the role of non-politicians in making policy. By non-politicians, I guess in particular, I'm meaning senior civil servants and how they interact with politicians in producing policy outcomes. When I started the research for this perhaps 6 or 7 years ago, traditionally we're used to a picture of political rhetoric being a domain owned by politicians. You know, they're on the television, they're on radio programs, laying out their wares for the public. But I was struck looking around how many other voices are emerging to be a part of that conversation. I was then intrigued to think how much of that engagement involves senior civil servants who were once the hidden parts of the machinery of government and are now out there much more on the public stage.
And should we worry about that?
The end point that I arrive at here, Lee, is that I think democracy is a messy business. Democracy, which is functioning well, is noisy, it's not linear, and it draws in lots of different perspectives. So I'm not uncomfortable with what I discern as a trend of a greater public engagement by senior civil servants. I think there are a couple of key lines here to keep in mind. Firstly, the nature of our representative democracy is that politicians are the final decision makers. They should stay the final decision makers, and nobody should interpret my arguments to mean that we should be ruled by a class of benevolent despots in the form of senior civil servants. That's not the argument. The argument is just, in order to allow politicians to arrive at good decision-making points and for the wider voting public to be able to determine how good those politicians are at making decisions, why not have a few more experienced, knowledgeable voices in the debate?
And those civil servants that are coming forward, whose voices we are hearing, who's bringing them forward? Is that their own choice to do that, or are they being urged forward by politicians?
In the book, I argue it's a little bit of both. Civil servants still enjoy a level of choice here about how much they choose to engage in that public sphere. There's a reactive component and a proactive component. The reactive component is essentially where you are drawn out largely without much choice. So if you are asked to appear before a select committee of the House of Commons to answer for part of your administration of public policy, there's not much you can do about that. A lot of those proceedings are now televised. In a 24/7 media world, a lot of gaffes, I guess, that civil servants might make in front of committees become wider news. That's then something that they need to manage, which is different from what I categorise as proactive, where you are choosing to insert yourself into a very salient public debate when you don't necessarily have to. That, I think, is where the debate becomes much hotter, much more contested, where politicians are then likely to potentially have a swipe at civil servants and their views. And so there's a line there of judgment for individual civil servants to engage with.
Is there a case of a civil servant doing this that sort of epitomises all the points that you're talking about?
There are several, and the book looks in particular at four Westminster system countries. So countries that are governed by the Westminster system of government, places like Australia, New Zealand and Canada. Across those four countries, there is some variations in practice. But during the Scottish referendum campaign, for example, the then Treasury Secretary publicly released some advice in conjunction with government about what would happen to the pound in the event of Scotland deciding to go independent and whether you could legitimately maintain a currency union without political union. Those public comments, that decision to enter the fray, was examined in depth afterwards by the Public Administration Committee, engaging with, is this okay for a civil servant to join a public debate? And it can even be around completely left-of-field issues, is probably the wrong description, but an issue that just emerges. So in 2013, when Margaret Thatcher passed away, the then Cabinet Secretary, the late Jeremy Haywood, and the then head of the civil service, Bob Kerslake, wrote an opinion piece for the Daily Telegraph, essentially discussing what it was like to work with Margaret Thatcher, intended to be, I think, an insight into the human being behind the political facade. And yet what followed, of course, is a very quite dramatic political confrontation, essentially, with some members of the opposition Labour Party around whether this had, in the words of one MP, sort of prostituted their high office by getting involved in what was perceived to be a political debate.
Because there is a line, isn't there, that civil servants aren't expected to cross. They used to be expected to almost be invisible.
I mean, that's right. And that line is becoming much blurrier in the modern era. So, you know, if we were to look back 50 or 60 years, this is an age of what I essentially categorise as governing in private. So we elect politicians to be the public face of policy making, expecting them to go to Westminster, connect with senior civil servants, whoever else they need to connect with to create policy, and then tell us what that policy is. The arguments around that policy occur in the back room, if you like. And I'm suggesting that the space for that back room is eroding, if not even disappearing, in this age of governing in public, where any level of policy debate and argument can very quickly, through social media, through a more investigative 24/7 news media, can draw those conversations into a more public domain. And I'm not saying that as a result, suddenly our senior civil servants have a Beyonce-like profile. You know, what I'm saying is that at any given moment, something they're working on or comments that they've made can be potentially drawn into a larger public argument.
But why is it happening? Because these civil servants have a choice. That hasn't changed.
That's true. And it's sort of a distinction here to be made between individual choice and institutional and other pressures that may be pushing or pulling you into the public domain. There are sort of three intersecting trends at play here. So that shift I've just described from governing in private to governing in public is interacting with a period of hyper-partisanship, I guess, where there are greater rewards, at least in the perception of politicians, for engaging potentially in some blame game activities with the senior civil service. So instead of defending your civil servants, you might actually say, look, politically we've done our best, but they're a block to what we want to do. This puts the civil service then in a position, do we fight back against that to defend ourselves, or do we take it and see where that leads? The final of the three intersecting trends, I think, is that we've perhaps in the last 10 years run into the end of this period where so-called evidence-based policy was ruling the roost, perhaps through the Blair years in particular, this idea that data and evidence drives policy making. What that era allowed us to forget is that an extra element to add to that is always persuasion. The reason we haven't solved climate change in a policy sense or homelessness in a policy sense is not because we don't know enough about it. It's not that we don't know what causes it. It's not even that we don't know what we need to do. It's because we haven't persuaded either our politicians or enough of the wider voting public about exactly what should be done. Evidence in and of itself is not enough. Increasingly, senior civil servants are then drawn into doing more with data to make a persuasive case. The fact that the head of MI5 in 2018 goes to Berlin to give a public speech around security and Russia and various threats, at one level is quite an extraordinary thing that we wouldn't have seen 20 years ago, because almost by definition, the head of your security agency is not about a public persuasion business, but I think they are becoming a part of it, whether they like it or not.
You start the book by asking the question, is politics broken? What did you conclude? Spoiler.
Spoiler alert. I think I am by trend of thought something of an optimist in this regard. There is always a tendency to look at contemporary politics and say, this is disastrous and this has never happened before. I don't think politics is broken. I think politics changes. It's always been changing. If we look at the extraordinary sort of ructions on the continent in 1968, if we look at periods of change when the Soviet Union collapsed, when the Labour Party has had splits in the past, when the Conservative Party has had splits in the past, if you actually look at the record closely, chaos is more normal than we think. So I don't think we should suddenly look at our politics from one year to the next and say it is now breaking. It's definitely under new strains. There are pressures from the electorate in terms of the kind of populist debates that are now out there, and there are unique policy challenges associated with Brexit, which are obviously causing our system of politics to stretch, but I don't think to break.
A Megaphone Democracy by Dennis Grube is published by Princeton University Press. Our studio guest on Bookmark today is Nicola Repson, here to talk about her novel Stanley and Elsie, based on the life of the artist Stanley Spencer. Nicola, obviously based on the life of the artist Stanley Spencer, based on real people, how far did you feel able to push it, given that it is based on real people?
Well, I think the lovely thing about Spencer and Hilda and Patricia and Dorothy is that I didn't really need to push it to make their story.
The truth is stranger than fiction.
The truth is stranger than fiction. You plot the outline of their association, and you really could not make that up. With Elsie, I felt much more able and free to create her as a semi-fictional character, even though she's very much based on the real Elsie. And it was lovely to bring out that relationship with Spencer. And people have said occasionally, is that an idealised relationship? Well, no, I don't think it is, because he, as I said earlier, he'd worked as a medical orderly. His war was in part about scraping the frostbite off patients' feet and emptying bedpans and carrying tea urns and all that sort of thing. So he had found a way to, the whole thing about the chapel is that he'd found a way to find God in the everyday. So the sort of services that Elsie was doing for him were very, very much something that he honoured and respected. But yes, Elsie is her own character, I think. And it was lovely to feel free in that way. And also, I think when you're dealing with real people, as I've done, as you said, in the Josephine Tay books, and not just with Tay herself, but with Alfred Hitchcock, Rowena Cade, people from theatre and politics and women's rights in those books, it's lovely to take what you know of them historically, but then to put them in fictional situations. And for me, obviously I would say this because I'm a novelist and not a biographer, but you bring out the kind of emotional truth of somebody's character. Not everything that happens in that book necessarily happens in the way I've said it happens, although most of it does. And yet I hope the picture that you're left with at the end of the book, the picture of those people that you're left with, is a truthful and accurate one.
Well, we'll listen to your second choice of music now, Nicola, which is Prelude by Kate Bush. Why this one?
Well, it's funny because I listeners regularly to 105 will know how much I love Kate Bush and how much I listen to her while I'm working. But it's what I went back was saying to you earlier about that sense. I remember my agent, Veronique, is also a big Kate Bush fan. So in the early stages of writing Stanley and Elsie, it's hard. It's easy to say what the book is going to be about, but it's hard to say what sort of book it's going to be. So I said to her, if you want to know what the tone of this book is, just listen to Prelude on Ariel, because it's that sense of, not bittersweet, but beauty and sadness and things lost. We spoke about how Spencer was always harking back to things that were lost. And I think there is a sense of that in this very short but very beautiful piece of music.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And we're talking to Nicola Upson today about her novel Stanley and Elsie, based on the life of Stanley Spencer. Nicola, did you like the character? I know you have to like your characters to a certain extent when you write them, but did you actually... Elsie, that's a given. We like Elsie. She's lovely. But the others?
I don't think you do have to like your characters, really. I think you have to empathise with your characters, and I think you have to be capable of putting yourself in their situation and asking why they behaved in the way they did. And from that point of view, yes, I can completely understand every separate character's point of view in that whole mess of the years that the book spans. And I did like Spencer. I also wanted to pick him up and shake him at times, because he was infuriatingly selfish and stupid at times. It's funny. There's a wonderful clip on, I think it's YouTube, of the late Sister Wendy Beckett standing in front of the double nude in the Fitzwilliam Museum. And she says something that I think is one of the most insightful things I've ever heard anybody say about Stanley Spencer, which is that his art understood where he as a man didn't. And I think you can see that. Everything about that doomed relationship with Patricia Priest is in that brutal, anatomically detailed, so shocking nude. But he as a man didn't understand that. I can understand Patricia's point of view. And one of the things that I was very keen from the outset that this book wouldn't do was to have a villain or to take sides. Because if you go to Cookham and you stand for a while in the Spencer Gallery or even out in the streets, you can hear people arguing. And Spencer is either portrayed as a genius and a saint, which he certainly wasn't a saint, or a ridiculously cruel eccentric, which he certainly wasn't either. Patricia is, well, because there were several reasons that the world was against Patricia. I mean, her relationship with Dorothy obviously had a lot of prejudice, regardless of even whether she had taken up with Stanley Spencer or not. But also, I can see how she got herself into that mess too, and hopefully that emerges from her character in the book. You might not always like Patricia, but hopefully I think you can understand and respect the relationship that she and Dorothy had. And it's interesting, I think, that they are now buried together in Cookham Cemetery, and there's a line on the gravestone that says united in life and in death, and they certainly were. And so I have a huge amount of respect for that relationship and for Dorothy's point of view, because there's been so much talk and so much attention paid to how Spencer destroyed his own family, and that's absolutely fair and right. But not much attention has been given to the fact that there was another lifelong relationship and love that was forever tarnished by those brief years, and that was Patricia's relationship with Dorothy.
Yes, I loved hearing from Dorothy. And you reference the picture taken on their wedding day,
yes,
on Patricia and Stanley's wedding day, which I did go and look at.
Good.
And you capture it perfectly. She's there with an enormous handbag.
Yes, she is. And you
sidelong glance.
Think, yeah, exactly. And you think what that must have been like. I do urge listeners, just Google Patricia Priest Stanley Spencer wedding and you will find this set of photographs. But she was there by the side of the woman that she loved, watching her marry another man. And no matter how you know in your head that relationship is not a real one compared to the relationship that you have with Patricia, that must have been heartbreaking. You can only begin to imagine, and that's one of my favourite sections of the book, really, was that and the subsequent honeymoon in St Ives, and imagining how Dorothy must have felt in those months.
And the discovery of the paintings in which she sees the relationship literally laid bare.
Yes, and I think that's a fictional device in the sense that it brings about a meeting and an understanding between Dorothy and Hilda in that, because they are looking at those nude paintings that I've described of Stanley with Patricia, and the shock and the revulsion that must have created in Dorothy is something that I really very much wanted to explore and sort of, you know, you don't write novels to be manifestos and put things on record, but to say, excuse me, Dorothy was there too.
And the chapel's really at the centre of the novel, I think. You come back to it at the end. And religion is very important to both Stanley and Hilda. She was a Christian scientist.
She was a Christian scientist, and that caused a lot of division in their marriage. It was a big bone of contention. Spencer's, I have no faith at all, but I have a lot of respect for Spencer's vision of heaven and God being in the everyday, which of course is what those resurrection paintings are all about. You know, I think that, say what you like about Stanley Spencer, he was a visionary and he never let no art training, no reading, no religious instruction, he never let the Stanley Spencer core of himself be knocked out. And that, of course, raises big questions, because that contributed to the selfishness that we've talked about. And it does raise the question of we now, as viewers and appreciators and lovers of his art, you know, how much, what right have we to put that ahead of the happiness and his affection and emotion for his family at the time? You know, we conveniently forget about all the pain that created that art. But there's no doubt, I think, that he is one of the most important artists of the 20th century and certainly one of the most interesting.
It was a pleasure to re-explore him again through the novel. Thank you, Nicola. Well, there's no easy way of shifting from Stanley Spencer to Monty Mouse of Cambridge Town, so I'm just going to dive in. Monty Mouse of Cambridge Town is a new children's book written by Kate Fleet with illustrations by Angela Kogo. I asked Kate, when I met her, to tell me what it was about.
It's about a small, very dapper mouse who lives just under the Museum of Cambridge. We're not sure exactly where. And he goes into town one day looking for lunch. So he goes along Bridge Street, he goes to the Round Church and various other places in the hope that he will find something very tasty to eat. So it takes in a few Cambridge landmarks and some of the maybe lesser known spots as well.
And why did you choose those particular streets?
Mainly because they're the streets I frequented pretty much every day when I was working at AFAS and thinking about writing the book, so it was kind of obvious to me that that's where they would end up being.
Where did the idea come from?
Monty is based on a real mouse who found his way into my friend's flat, and we caught him in an ice cream box and let him out in a field, and he was just so cute. And I started to have this story forming in my mind of, well, what if he was living in Cambridge? And that's basically it. He's based on a real mouse.
And what kind of age is it aimed at?
I suppose 3 to 6 year olds. And then I think any adult who has a place in their heart for Cambridge would like it too.
Nice for tourists, actually, as a memento.
Absolutely, yeah. And they have been buying it.
Yeah, it's been selling really well. You must be absolutely delighted.
Yeah, we're thrilled. It's great, yeah.
And so what came first, the words or the pictures? You've got Angela's the illustrator here. Did you two know each other beforehand?
Yeah, we used to be flatmates, actually, but Kate wrote the story a few years ago, and then she gave it to me to read. She asked me if I would be interested in doing the illustrations, and I said yes, and then started the collaboration, yeah.
And because it's real streets in Cambridge, did you have to go to the streets to get a sense of the lighting and the bricks and that kind of thing?
Yeah, of course. I work in the city centre as well, so I did that walk so many times. But I did spend some time doing some sketching on the spot, and I did take a lot of pictures as well and use that for my illustrations as well.
I'm guessing some of the places in the book, a pleasure to draw because it's such a picturesque place.
Absolutely. I mean, Cambridge is gorgeous, so it's really a pleasure to draw all the buildings and the places and the atmosphere, and yeah.
And is it something you've wanted to do for a long time, write a children's book?
No, I hadn't even given it a thought. I did used to work as a children's bookseller, and obviously I was surrounded by books every day, but I didn't really expect to write one myself until the stories sort of started to come to me, and I thought, oh, maybe I should write this down. Then it became a complete story, and then I kind of wondered what to do with it, and then I met Angela and thought, aha.
And you made it hard for yourself because it's in rhyme.
Yeah, although I found that really fun, actually, and spent quite a lot of time, you know, making sure that the rhythm was right. No half rhymes, things like that. It's not easy to get it right, but I think it was worth it.
And in terms of writing for that readership, you've got to think about language, I suppose, and what words they'll understand and what words they won't.
Yes, although there's a couple of words in there that may be slightly old-fashioned and may need to be explained by a parent, but I don't think you should miss those out as part of the story. It would just add to their vocabulary.
And in terms of the illustration, obviously, if you're aiming at that age group, mm-hmm. What do they do to the story? They illustrate the story, but do they add something else as well?
I think so. I mean, I hope so. They bring you to the places that the story tells you about, but at the same time, there's a lot of little details that are not in the words and that you can find out just looking at the pictures as well. I tried to do that and have maybe some side little stories that are not happening in the text, but that you can find out. Yeah. And I think that might be quite interesting for a child to look at.
There's more going on than meets the eye.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I suppose you're aware that for that age group, it's going to be an adult reading it to a child. So you want to give them something extra to go on, something that's maybe not just for the adult, but gives them something extra to talk about.
Definitely. And I think that that's where the collaboration really showed, because that wasn't there in the original text. But then we shared ideas and Angela made some suggestions as well. And so the kind of subplot came out of that.
How long did the whole process take?
Probably worked on it obviously not all the time, but over the course of 8 months or so, you know, I worked full-time, it wasn't my focus, and because I didn't really know what I was going to do with it, but I felt like about 8 months to a year, it was done. And then it sat there for a while until I met Angela, and then you were finishing your MA in book illustration, so it needed to wait a bit longer.
The illustrations and the design part took about a year and a half, something like that, because I'm also working part-time, so yeah, it was a bit of doing a lot of things at the same time.
And is it watercolours that you've used?
Yeah, just watercolours and pencil, yeah.
Why did you use watercolours?
It's my favourite medium to use at the moment, and the one that I feel more confident in as well, and I think it suited the project very well, so I went for something that I was comfortable with and that looked, I think, appropriate.
And how was it for you, Kate, to see Monty come to life? Was he how you imagined him?
I had a vague idea in my head, but it was great to see somebody with real drawing talent, you know, have him appear on the page and say, look, here he is. Yeah, it's great. I love what she's done with him.
And you both work at Heifers, so you can see the book, literally see the book being sold and obsessively check on the sales figures if you so wish. How is that, seeing people buy it?
It's amazing. Obviously, you hope that they will, but when it's actually happening, yeah, and I have been obsessively checking, it's true.
You work in the children's book department.
I do, yes. I have not been obsessively checking. I try not to, actually, because it makes me a little bit nervous. But yeah, no, it's really good to see when someone picks it up and the reaction that they have, especially if it's a child. Mm. Yeah, that's really comforting and just very nice.
So what next for both of you? Will Monty have more adventures?
He has certainly had them. I'm hoping they get to be told as well. We need to talk about that. But yeah, there's more adventures up the sleeve, definitely.
And what about you, Angela? Yes, you're happy to do more Monty and more illustrating on the cards?
Well, I hope that I will do more illustrating, of course. But for now, yeah, I'm just enjoying the fact that I finished my first picture book. And I don't know, I will see what other opportunities come to me after this.
And you studied here, is that right?
Yes, I did master in children's book illustration at Anglia Ruskin. I graduated a couple of years ago, yeah, before starting Monty.
And that's, of course, with such a brilliant reputation.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic course. The professors are amazing and there's a lot of interesting and great artists that come out of the master. Yeah, it's a really great place to start.
Monty Mouse of Cambridge Town by Kate Fleet and Angela Kogo is published by Galileo. We've been talking today on Bookmark to Nicola Upson about her novel Stanley and Elsie, which is published by Duckworth. So, Nicola, what next for you then?
Well, all summer I've been trying to conjure up Christmas in my head because I'm writing the next Josephine Tay, which will come out the following Christmas. But in the meantime, the eighth book in that series, Sorrow for the Dead, is going to be published in November. So some nice events to look forward to for that.
So she's still fascinating you. You're still finding her.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, Stanley and Elsie was quite a difficult book to leave behind, but it took me a while to come back to Josephine. But no, she is an incredible woman, and the series hasn't yet even got to the period of work for which we most love her. So no, I think there are a lot of talking about Monty and his adventures. There are a lot more adventures for Josephine to come too.
And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark: what are you reading at the moment?
I am, like many other people at the moment, I'm reading The Testaments, which is an interesting experience for me because I'm simultaneously also reading Mandy's next book, which will come out in the spring, which is called The Ice Maid's Tale. So you will probably gather that there is a connection between those two books. And the book that I am finding really, really difficult to leave behind at the moment is a novel set in 1930s rural Suffolk called All Among the Barley by Melissa Harrison, which is a beautiful, beautiful tale. It's quietly devastating. And I although I finished it quite some time ago, it's still with me. And the writing is just beautiful.
Thank you, Nicola. And if people want to hear you again, they can. You're at the Cambridge Literary Festival.
Yes, doing at the Fitzwilliam Museum, doing an event with Frances Spaulding talking about Stanley and Elsie. And there'll be an opportunity then, obviously, to see the paintings, some of which we've been talking about today.
And you can find out more about that on the Cambridge Literary Festival website. Just a heads up that our studio guest for the next show is Jennifer Wallace. She'll be talking about tragedy since 9/11, Reading a World Out of Joint, her book about how tragedy and literature can inform our understanding of world events. We'll also hear from children's author Janet Bingham and YA author Bex Hogan. But we'll leave you now with Nicola Epson's last choice of music, which is The Dancing by June Tabor. Why this one, Nicola?
It is why I love June Tabor. Gabor, and I listen to a lot. There's a melancholy tone to her music, which suits a lot of the things I write. But I've chosen this for Elsie, the dancing, because Elsie was folk dancing well into her 80s. And I imagine that the one in the song is very much the sort of dance that she and her reluctant husband would have been going to.